Hello everyone, this is Mike Quincy connecting the light. My guest today is William Whitecloud. He is Australia's number one best-selling author of The Magician's Way and has launched his latest book called The Last Shaman quite recently, and it is an adventure story set in war-torn Swaziland in Africa. And The Last Shaman is also a truly transformative shamanic journey that some have called a cross between Indiana Jones and Carlos Castaneda. And I'll just finally add that the book is a teaching tool designed, like Whitecloud's work, to deepen the appreciation and understanding of the reader's intuition and how they can use it to live soul-inspired lives. So welcome to the program, William.
Thank you, Mike. Wonderful to be with you.
Now, just let me ask you something, not about your book, but about your name. You've got a wonderful surname there, which rather suggests you've got an American Indian background. I mean, is there any story to your name?
No, there is a story to it, but it's not an American Indian. But it's not surprising you say that. A lot of people think that. But actually, you know, Whitecloud was my nickname.
Oh, and, I see. Right.
Used to be my nickname. It was started by a girlfriend of mine, and it really used to be annoy me, actually. And anyway, then when I got into what I'm into now, I sort of thought, well, you know, it was a bit of a sign that is really reflective of my nature and what I'm about. And I just took it on as my non-diplume, my writer's name, whatever. And, you know, so now I happily use it. And the interesting thing about it, though, is that Whitecloud is found in many cultures as a surname. It's a Scottish surname, and at one time there were two professors at the same time at Oxford University with the surname of Whitecloud. And in the town in which I live in Australia, there are three Whitecloud families, and it's a very common Chinese name as well. So, you know, it's I've got a very universal name, not just
Absolutely.
American Indian.
Right. Oh, well, I was just curious about that. That would have been, I suppose, very appropriate for the work you're in, which is, of course, what you've acknowledged. Now, it might be as well if you just told our listeners just a little bit of the background to The Last Shaman, in the sense that you have told us it picks up where The Magician's Way left off. So tell us very briefly how you gave people information so that they could tap into their natural creative ability, and then we can go into your current book.
I don't think I really understood the question. Do you want me to tell people about the generally what the latest book, The Last Shaman, is? Or
no, I was talking about your earlier book, The Magician's Way. Right, and you intimated that the second book picked up where the first one left off. So,
exactly, yes.
And you spoke about it telling people how they could learn to tap into their natural creative ability. So what I thought is maybe if you just covered that briefly.
Yeah, then, no, sure, Mike. I'm with you.
Okay.
You know, the Magician's Way was the first book in this duology, and basically that was a story about a character who goes through an adventure, and in that adventure basically learns how to use his natural ability, because I believe we all have a natural ability that we can rely on that can, see us through life far better than when we, you know, rely on and look to take our cues from outside of ourselves. I find it really interesting with the whole idea of education, and the word education coming from the term educare, which means to draw out of, to bring forth, and really, you know, the whole education system as I experience it, and even as I see my kids going through it now, is really not about what's inside of us. It really actually gives us to understand that there's nothing inside of us, and that we have to learn from outside of ourselves what it's all about. And you know, that there is a way and that we don't know the way. I'll just give you a quick example. My daughter, for instance, who writes very beautifully, both in America, well, originally in Australia, at a different school in Australia, now here in America, gets heavily criticized and almost punished for the way she holds the pen. And so she's given to understand that she doesn't know the way to do something, although the end result, which is her handwriting, is very efficient and beautiful. And it's kind of like that. That's our education system. That's the experience we come from, where, as I was saying, we don't really have a sense that we know, and yet actually we do. We have, great powers within us and, great abilities that come to us naturally, that when we do rely on them, that they cause our lives to go in a very positive way. And so the magician's way was really just about that, was about learning to rely on that side of yourself and techniques as well that could get you in touch with your natural ability and working from that. And now the Last Shaman, though, is an extension of that. And very much along the lines, the theme of the Last Shaman is basically that we're all being guided, which I believe to be a profound truth, and that every moment of our lives we're actually being guided to the higher possibilities available for us. And so, through the form of story, and it's the same character, just learning the extended advanced lessons, learning what it takes to get in touch with and follow guidance, basically.
Fine. What's your, not having read your first book, do I take it from the way you've described it that that was also a novel?
It was, yeah. And as I say, the Last Shaman is the sequel to the Magician's Way. They're both stories. They're both what they call allegorical novels, which means a story that conveys a message. And I don't know, it's a very difficult mix to get right. It's not many people like the allegorical novels. They're really popular. I believe I've managed to get the mix just right. The Magician's Way was the best-selling metaphysical book in Australia's history. I mean, it was a very popular book. And if you can get it right, then story is a very good way of conveying messages, because people assimilate the lessons very powerful. When you're reading a story, the brain does. Scientists have told us now, have discovered that the brain doesn't really distinguish between a character and yourself. So it's almost like when you read a story, you actually practice the information rather than just take it on conceptually and intellectually. Though it is really tricky to get right, but somehow, thankfully, I seem to have managed that, Mike.
Right. Now, you grew up in Africa, so did that background greatly influence you in the work you're doing today and your book in particular?
Well, most definitely. And in particular, one way, which is this, is that when I was growing up in Africa and in Swaziland, which, by the way, is where I grew up, and it's not where the Last Shaman is set. The Last Shaman is set in a fictitious setting in Africa. But I grew up in Swaziland, a very small country in Africa. And when I was born in my early childhood, the part of the country that I grew up in was, really wild. I mean, the full of wild animals and wild people. Everyone around me was either naked or just in skins, as they had been for thousands of years before any European settlers arrived there. And, their worldview, Mike, was just totally different, if you can imagine, just totally different than our Western worldview. I mean, to the average Swazi walking around in those days, self-conscious waking reality, wasn't actually a reality to them. It was just something to be seen through to the deeper spiritual forces and the deepest supernatural forces at play. And so, I just assimilated that as though I was breathing oxygen, that kind of worldview, which was very you know, quickly stamped out of me once I went to the series of colonial-style, Christian-style boarding schools that I went to. You know, I was very quickly given to understand that the way I saw things, the way I had been brought up to see things, was just superstitious nonsense and impractical and didn't fit in with the material, mechanical world of progress that we were all involved in, supposedly. And so, you know, for a large part of my life, you know, that was buried in me. But when I came back to being involved in the work that I'm involved in now and living the way that I live now, funnily enough, it's a way of living by which you actually are informed by seeing through your self-conscious, rational, linear faculties and perceptions to the deeper forces at play in terms of what's going on in your consciousness, what's going on in the world, what's going on in your life, and being able to align yourself to those energies, those forces that are going to take you forward in the most constructive way and lead to you living, and myself, lead to me living and creating in line with my highest destiny and possibility. So now I look back on it and I think, well, that was a very good foundation for me.
Yeah, so your experiences evidently must have shaped or formed your spiritual development as well.
Well, absolutely, and you know, in line with that, as I say, it was also very repressed in me once I came into contact with the British colonial Christian education system. I guess that the way that you would what you would say is that I originally had kind of a spirituality, a spiritual connection, which was then just stamped out of me into this kind of institutional view of the world of a very mechanical, materialistic, progress-orientated world and life. And I would have never have thought of myself or termed myself, called myself a spiritual by any means. But, you know, now I've gone back to that, and I definitely would identify with being spiritual and also having that, you know, sense of connection to the inner rather than just only the outer, basically. And in that sense, I consider myself spiritual. To me, that is more what spiritual means than anything else.
Right. Now, I don't know what age you were, but I believe you possibly were the younger man when you had a long-term chronic illness, which you overcame by quite a unique method. Would you like to tell us about that?
Sure. You know, I mean, because it's a defining point in my life was when I became ill, and I was a you know young man in my early 20s when I became ill, and it was a long-term illness. I was sick for 10 years, and over that time became progressively more and more ill till I actually arrived on my deathbed. I mean, I was at the end literally dying, and I know that because I remember getting deathbed counseling and thinking to myself, this isn't a good sign. And you know, the thing about the curious thing about that illness was that nobody could diagnose what it was. You can imagine. I went to see every kind of healer and physician, professor in many continents, actually, and not one of them could say what was wrong with me, because which is very unusual, because in my experience now, with myself and anyone else, there's always someone who thinks that they know what's wrong with you and very quick to tell you. But in that instance, nobody could tell me what was wrong with me. And anyway, in the end, I met this young man, a strapping, healthy young man, who was a fitness instructor. And, you know, he in turn was quite a bit younger than me by then. And we got talking, and the conversation very quickly turned to my health, obviously, because my condition was so obvious. And very soon... very soon into the conversation, he said, I know what's wrong with you. I had that very thing, which totally surprised me, because no one could relate to me. No one could understand what was going on for me. And here was a man saying he knew what was wrong with me. Not only that, that he had had the same thing himself. That's what he maintained. And actually, when he described to me what his condition and problem had been, I could totally relate, and I really understood him, and I knew for absolute certainty, for sure, that he must have had what I had. And yet, here he was before me, very fit and healthy, and he told me that he had the cure, that he had cured himself, and that I could cure myself with the same cure. And so I was very excited to hear that, as weakened, you know, low energy as I was. But then I was very deflated when he told me what the cure was, because the remedy was. He told me I should eat red meat and start drinking white wine and smoking some cigarettes every day and having a few cups of coffee every day. And so you can imagine how confronted I was by that, because to anyone, even now that I even mention those substances, everyone has a negative connotation with them mostly. And certainly in my condition back then, although all of the physicians and healers and doctors and therapists that I had been to see, while none of them knew what was wrong with me, I can guarantee you all of them would have agreed that what the guy was saying was just, you know, mumbo-jumbo, basically. And not only that, in my condition, a prescription for, you know, for suicide, virtually. And I knew that, but anyway, there was something about my condition by then, and also the degree to which I could relate to the guy, that I just went, you know, what the hell, what have I got to lose? I'll do what he says, and I became well in no time. I mean, it took me no time at all to bounce back. Sure, it took me quite a long time, months even, you know, for my weight to come back, and sores on my body to heal and that sort of thing, but generally for my wits to come back and my faculties, my energy, I was back in business in a week. I'm not kidding. And the thing about that, though, is that I've had a lot of arguments with people about the efficacy of those substances and, you know, what happened. And the thing is that what people don't seem to realize or to get is I don't care. Because I never, ever thought that there was any efficacy in those substances. I mean, to this day, I eat red meat very rarely. I hardly drink. I detest smoking, and coffee just freaks me out. Caffeine just makes me crazy. So I'm not fans of those substances anyway. But and I never, ever actually considered that those substances had any efficacy. What struck me, what really hit me and, you know, impressed itself on me profoundly was the sense that there must be some way in which I focus that then determines my experience in life. It wasn't lost on me. In fact, the opposite. It was very clear to me. I could see, looking back, I could see very clearly just how obsessed with being ill I was and desperate I was to find the cure, and not thinking that there was anything in me that would, you know, affect me in any way, and looking outside of myself to experts for the answers, looking for healing from outside of myself, some substance, some power from somewhere outside of myself. And, you know, I just deteriorated over those 10 years. And then when my attention was taken off that, and I just went, what the hell, you know. I'm throwing out all these herbal tinctures I'm taking, and I'm throwing out all these vitamin supplements they've got me on and the boiled cabbage that they've got me on. And, you know, and I bounced back. And I didn't understand it, Mike. I didn't understand exactly how it worked. But I was absolutely sure that there was some way in which my focus created my reality. And so that sent me on the course that I've been on for the last 20 years, which was to discover, you know, how this principle actually works so that I could use it to create my heaven on earth instead of the hell on earth that I'd just experienced and now knew or was certain in myself that I had created that somehow. I was sick for a very long time. I was sick for 10 years, and nobody knew what was wrong with me, and nobody could help me. In the end, I met a young guy who told me that he had had what I had, the illness that I had, and that he had cured himself of the illness, and that, you know, he could give the remedy to me. And so he told me that I had to eat lots of red meat, drink white wine, smoke cigarettes, and have coffee every day, which was a very confronting prescription. Which, yes. Yeah, I mean, everyone I'd been seeing, even though they didn't, know at all what was wrong with me, they would have all agreed that this was a prescription for suicide. And, it was my sense as well, obviously. But I did, by then I had nothing to lose. And also, I was hoping that, having spoken to this guy and sensed that he really had had what I had, I was really just hoping against all hope that he was telling the truth. And anyway, I tried what he suggested, and I got better immediately. And from that, what I got out of that, I mean, it was a profound experience for me to be taken over 10 years to my deathbed without any hope whatsoever, and then to be so dramatically freakishly actually cured. Was as I say, a really profound profound experience in my life. And the thing that impressed on me was that I didn't believe there was any efficacy in the substances that he had prescribed, but rather that there must be some way in which I focused, that then determined my experience in life. And so, because of the fact that just simply that, I'd just been so obsessed with being sick for so long, and all my attention had gone into that. And then when I just let go of that preoccupation, that morbid preoccupation, really, I got better. And so I didn't understand how this worked, but I knew there must be some way in which it worked. And, obviously, having had such a profound effect on me, I determined to discover how this principle worked so that I could use it to create my heaven on earth rather than the hell on earth that I just experienced over 10 years. And so that set me on the course that I've been on for the last 20 years, learning just exactly how our focus creates our reality, and, putting it to effect in my life and passing it on to others as best as I can.
Do you mean that once you were better, you still carried on the same way, or did you go back to a more, vegetarian type diet?
Oh, yeah, no, I've never been a vegetarian, but also, I just don't eat a lot of red meat anyway, and I'm not a big drinker, and, coffee freaks me out. Caffeine just freaks me out. I can't take it, and yeah. I detest smoking. I didn't, as soon as I was better, I didn't have any more cigarettes and I didn't have any more coffee or anything like that. So it's not a regimen I've kept up at all. And, one or two times after that, I started going down with things. I thought, well, this is the remedy for it, and tried it and it didn't work. It was just that one time experience. And all that's important to me is that it gave me that insight. People argue with me till the cows come home about all aspects of that experience, other than the people that know me who saw me, saw it happen before their eyes and witnessed it. But otherwise, everybody else has got something to say about it. Their theory on why it worked or how it couldn't have worked or whatever. And, I don't care because it is not important. The actual substances themselves, to me, are kind of almost like a red herring. The thing that I took away from it is what's important to me. And whether it was the right thing to take away from it or not, I don't know. But it's what I took away from it, and it, you know, gave me an interest in life that I've been following through to this day that has dramatically changed my life and then also serves other people in changing theirs and, you know, living their lives to the fullest.
It's extremely interesting. I haven't heard any parallel to that type of experience. That's most unusual. I've heard the reverse, where someone changed from that type of lifestyle and reckoned that all sorts of illnesses came upon them, and then when they reverted to it, they stopped. So it's a similar experience. Anyway...
I know. Most of the stories I hear are exactly the opposite.
Yeah? Yes, indeed. It's most strange, but at least it worked for you. Now, to write a book about the Last Shaman, have you had some experience of shamanism yourself?
I knew nothing about shamanism until I decided to write The Last Shaman, because I didn't set out to write a book about shamanism. It's just like the magician's way, Mike. I knew very little about magic before I wrote the book. And, you know, the magician's way I'm talking about. But it's all about metaphor. And I look for metaphors through which I can tell my stories and translate the information I want to translate, the most appropriate metaphors. And so I wanted to convey, you know, I was looking for a story that would convey the teachings that I do in The Last Shaman and essentially the theme, which is that we're being guided and that you can learn to follow your guidance. And so I was holding out for a story that would be a really good metaphor and a really good vehicle to convey these teachings. And then one day I was in Africa with my elder brother, and he introduced me to a guy who was Africa's foremost rock art expert, a tribe of people that had lived through southern Europe and all of Africa for thousands and thousands of years. In fact, their paintings on cave walls can be found in Spain that date back 27,000 years. And so this expert, Victor, he took me out into the field and showed me a bunch of paintings, you know, and one of them dating back, they had dated back 6,000 years, and in remarkable condition and remarkable quality. Some of the, you know, some of the images were almost photographic in quality. And he also told me the story behind each painting. You know, I'd seen many of these paintings when I was a kid growing up, a bit cruder than these paintings that he showed me, but nevertheless the same sort of theme and style. And we always used to assume from the images on the rock walls that they were depictions of hunting stories, like almost like it was their trophy room or something, or depictions of clan warfare. But what he disabused me of all those ideas, and what he helped me realize by showing me what was going on in those paintings was that they were all actually depictions of shamanic journeys into the other world, where the shaman goes into the other world and, you know, by creating a harmony in that world, then creates a corresponding harmony back in our own waking self-conscious three-dimensional world. So through that I learned that essentially what shamanism was or is, and that particularly that type of shamanism, although I now have discovered there's a very strong correspondence between all shamanisms of all tribes and races throughout the time, that a lot of it has to do with, you know, healing, rainmaking, and divining wisdom, which is acquired in the other world. So traveling on drums or horses or whatever it is into the other world, working on that world, and then through whatever is done in that world, in the other world, then creates this corresponding harmony in our world, you know, well, you could create the rain they want, or the healing on a patient or the divining of the wisdom for the elders of the tribe or whatever it is. And so that was my introduction really to shamanism, but also it was the gift of the story, because when I heard that story, and you know, I heard them several times because we saw several of these paintings around in the field, and it's the same story essentially, fundamentally, and I really got the story. And I thought to myself, it hit me, what a story here. What if I could take this character of mine who is urgently in need of some wisdom and the getting of wisdom, and what if I could take him into this other world where, you know, what happens in that world and the lessons he has in that world prepare him for life back on the outside in our world, and also affects his world here positively. And so, you know, that was the basis of my story, where I do take the character into another world, not so much a spiritual world, but a very different world. And, you know, that's the story. And you know, these stories are very popular, and they're very common in our society. I mean, Alice in Wonderland is a shamanic story. There's a movie now about The Wizard of Oz, you know, where he got his start. And the Lord of the Rings almost is a shamanic story, but definitely the Narnia Chronicles are shamanic stories. These stories of people going into other dimensions where they have problems on this side in this world. And then they go into these other worlds, these fantastical, imaginative worlds, where they, you know, develop the resources, refine their characters, or do whatever it takes, then to come back equipped and able to deal with whatever's happening for them in their real life. And that is very much the nature of a shamanic story. And as I say, they're very popular and powerful stories too. And it's not why I did this. I didn't go, you know, I should write a shamanic story because Lewis Carroll had a lot of success with his. You know, but it's just how it turned out. And then just reflecting, I go, you know, this is not uncommon in our society to convey learnings through the process of going into another imaginative world where we can, you know, create a metaphor for what we have to learn to deal more functionally and powerfully with our own world, basically.
Right, yes. It's interesting that you should mention the ancient cave paintings. It was only today that I was watching a documentary on the television, and they were showing that to some extent they do seem to indicate that these ancient peoples were visited by extraterrestrials, because some of the drawings are very, you might say, easily identifiable today in light of our own experience of sending people into space and the sort of equipment they wear. So that was quite interesting, I thought. Now,
The cover of my book actually has a painting of has a photograph actually of a cave painting, and there is, yes, a character there who really looks like a spaceman, and it is very interesting. Also, the thing is about you see that they took a lot of sort of psychotropic medicine as well, and. Yes. When people take psychotropic medicine, they often report meeting extraterrestrials, so it's not surprising.
Yeah. It could be, it perhaps has a similar, the medicine, I mean, has a similar effect to drugs, which alters your vibration very slightly, and then you perhaps see things that you wouldn't otherwise.
Yeah, well, it opens you up to other dimensions. And I call it medicine in, you know, in respect of people who use these substances. You know, I think, you know, normally people would just call them drugs, but to the people who use them ritually, it's not, you know, it's not a It's not a drug. It's not an escapist vehicle. It's actually a medicine. It's a spiritual medicine. So, you know, one man's medicine is another man's drug, I guess.
Yeah. Now, you were talking about people sort of altering their self in a way by taking these medicines. Is that in any way connected with some of the themes in your story about shape-shifting?
No, I mean, you know, there are scenes in which people take medicine in the book, but it's unrelated to shape-shifting, because shape-shifting, in its most literal sense, is the ability to transform from one body into another, from human form into the shape of a lizard or an owl or coyote or whatever it is. And, you know, I grew up in a shape-shifting culture in Swaziland. They were a shape-shifting culture where, you know, if you might see a baboon, say, and this is back in the day, you might see a baboon and point it out to one of the Swazis, to one of the Africans, and they go, oh, you know, that's not a baboon. That's my friend Langa or whoever. He often gets around as a baboon. And so it always used to perplex me, to be honest. And it was only till afterwards when I was grown up and read stories about shape-shifting from other cultures that, you know, I understood more about what it was about. But you see, the thing is about shape-shifting also, again, it's in its literal sense, whether you take it literally or not, doesn't matter, because as a metaphor, it's very true. Shape-shifting is a psychic ability, actually. And you can argue about whether it's literally true or not, and it's beside the point to me anyway, because it's an intuitive psychic technique. Normally, when we look at something, we look at anything, we see it from the point of view of our identity. We don't see things for what they are. To give you an example, is we look at a stone, and from our identity, from our perception, we see it as an inanimate object. And so what shape-shifting is to see things from the point of view of the thing itself, rather than from our perspective of our identity. And so it's a function of embodiment. It's a function of imaginatively becoming what you want to know about, so that you know about something by being it. And then when you become it, imaginatively anyway, then you know it from a very different perspective than what your identity, what your perception has held it to be. And, you know, a friend of mine used to be a follower of a guru called Osho Rajneesh, who was quite a radical guy and was labeled by the Indian government as a spiritual terrorist of all things. Now, this friend of mine used to sit at his feet and listen to the guy talk, and because he was so radical, I think he also had a radical following, and, you know, his disciples weren't just fawning disciples. You know, they would test and challenge him. And one day Osho was talking about Sufis and Sufism, and one of his disciples in the crowd in front of him called out, "What do you know about Sufis? Are you a Sufi?" And so Osho's reply to him was, "Well, no, I'm not a Sufi, but when I talk about Sufis, I am a Sufi." And, you know, when my friend told me this, I got it immediately, what Osho is talking about, is that what he's saying is that he's not just talking about it from his perspective. When he talks about Sufism, he actually embodies Sufism. He becomes Sufism. He shapeshifts into it, and so then talks about it from the perspective of being it, rather than thinking and feeling about it and knowing about it from what he's learned and, you know, what he believes, etc. He is it. And you know, it's just like that. I mean, I do a lot of shape-shifting as an intuitive psychic practice and train a lot of people in that ability. And going back to the rock or to the stone that we just see as inanimate, when I teach people to shape-shift, the first thing I do is get them to shape-shift into objects, to become objects. like a rock or a tree or whatever. And so everyone reports that when they shapeshift into a stone, they come back going, holy cow, you know, it's not what I thought it was. It's actually, first of all, not as material as I thought it was, and secondly, it's not as inanimate as I thought it was. And so, you know, shapeshifting is not a function of, you know, any effects of substances. It's just a self-conscious, imaginative tool that we all have at our disposal.
Hmm. Well, that's a very deep and interesting explanation. What made me ask you that, amongst other reasons, was the very intriguing and riveting story in some ways about the fish eagle.
Yeah, that's right, because that's a scene in the book where he does shapeshift into an animal, and I don't want to say too much about that because it's a very central part of the story, the
yes.
whole shapeshifting theme. But there's a bit of shapeshifting that goes on in the book, which is what people then draw comparisons to Carlos Castaneda, because although I haven't read a lot of his books, but I think that you know, he also was big on shapeshifting, talked a lot about shapeshifting. Although in the books that I read with Carlos Castaneda, I always got the sense, the impression, and you know, I might have been wrong because I was very young when I read them, but always got the impression, I know all my friends took it as a very literal meaning, you know, and we all thought, well, we should be able to literally become owls and coyotes and what it, ravens or whatever. And but you know, anyway, since then I have a deeper understanding of it, a more useful understanding anyway, because shapeshifting is a very powerful intuitive technique. As I say, it's an incredibly powerful system for formulating information that you otherwise could never formulate, to help you see things beyond what your normal rational perception will allow you to see. And, hence its place in the book, which is basically, you know, really, while The Last Shaman is a story, and I fancy that it is an interesting story, a riveting story, it's, you know, it is also the vehicle for conveying that ability for people to, you know beyond what they just normally, rationally would self-consciously know and believe, to see through that, to have a higher sense of a deeper sense of wisdom and insight and self-awareness into themselves and life, that they can then use to navigate themselves in line with their highest destiny, their highest possibility, which you know, might actually sound kind of airy-fairy in one sense when you listen to it in that way. But at the end of the day, what that really means is that, you know, an ability to live in a way that success comes very naturally to you in life, which, you know, if you asked anyone, if success could be a natural part of your life, would you take that? I mean, you know, everyone would. And the thing is about it is in our intuition is our inherent ability. It's our God-given mode of awareness that basically actually allows us to live in a way that success in every area of our life is just a natural part of it.
Right. So do you think then that if shape-shifting isn't true to our reality and is not possible, that in fact some people can project their consciousness into another animal or bird and experience what it's like to be that particular thing?
Oh, absolutely. And I don't discount shapeshifting, by the way, as a literal experience. I mean, you know, I just come from a worldview, or, you know, that as much as it was affected by a superconscious worldview, I still come from a very concrete, rational worldview that I was brought up into. So just because I can't see it and can't accomplish it doesn't mean I can't, that other people can't, and perhaps do. I'm just saying that even if I can't accomplish it literally, I can certainly accomplish it as a psychic tool. But to answer your question, definitely, and that is the way also. I've got a little squirrel here calling me now as we're talking outside. They come around for some nuts every day, and they're here now begging for some out the window here. Very cute. And, you know, I mean, I have the ability to, anybody has the ability to project themselves into these squirrels and you know, really have an experience of being that squirrel and knowing how that squirrel kind of functions and sees things and whatever. So it's absolutely possible.
Right. Now, let's move on to another subject that comes up in your book, which I find very interesting, is you say that the premise of The Last Shaman is that we are all being guided by a higher force or power, and that it is available for each one of us to follow that guidance to the richest life possible. So what is that higher power, and how would you recommend people try to connect with it?
Well, I don't know what the higher power is exactly, Mike. You know, and nobody knows, and I would rather not know because it is unknowable, and I would rather remain in the mystery, basically, and I'll tell you why. But you know, what I find, and this is very interesting, is that when people are focused on end results, the funny thing is how... The interesting thing is just how powerfully those end results will tend to manifest. First of all, they will tend to manifest, and secondly, they will tend to manifest more powerfully than they would without the focus. And here's the interesting thing, though, is that it doesn't matter what people believe the power is that brings them that. You know, some people might be religious and could pray for it and through their prayer be focused on it. Others, like myself, are more secular and just see it in terms of an imaginative function of visualization and choosing. Some people think that it's their own super conscious side of themselves. Other people call it the universe. But it doesn't matter what it is. Well, it doesn't matter what people call it. It still works equally no matter what you call it. The main thing is about it is that one is, through whatever premise, you know, focused on end results, that you can then manifest those end results. So when I you know, what I think it is, I'm not sure, but it's a power outside of my own rational linear function. And I think your question was, well, how do people engage that? What is it, and how do people engage it? And really, I believe there's some serious misconceptions that we are bound by in life. And, you know, one of these misconceptions is that our perception of the meaning of our lives, the myth of our life, you know, the framework for understanding the meaning of our lives, really, seems to be, for generally everybody, that here we are faced with a bunch of circumstances and problems and situations in our life that happen to us, that you know, randomly happen to us, and that our purpose is to, you know, navigate our way through these problems, situations, circumstances, and that the way to do that is to figure it out, to work it out, basically. And the person with the strongest rational function, the strongest rational capability, the person with the most knowledge and the strongest mind to that's capable of working things out, figuring it out, is going to do best in getting through their situations, their circumstances, their problems, which is actually might seem that way and feel like that, but it's not true, because figuring it out and working it out and understanding things and having preconceived knowledge is a rational function. And so when we try and figure our lives out, when we try and work our lives out, then we're handing over to the rational part of ourselves, because it's a rational function. We're handing over to the rational part of ourselves that, in the first place, formulated, devised our identity, devised our incomplete, separate, limited sense of self. So we're just handing over to that side of ourselves, which then perpetuates that worldview, that perception. It sees it that way and then perpetuates what it sees. And so we just keep ourselves in a very limited pattern of experience of life. And so if we mean to get out of that and have a higher experience of us, of life and ourselves, and a broader experience of life and ourselves, and a more effective experience, then we've got to get out of that way of thinking. And so to get out of that way of thinking, we've got to do something that's really contrary to our sense of how it is. And we have to actually soften our focus. And instead of needing to know how it is, we've got to let go of knowing how it is. We've got to go into the mystery. We've got to go into innocence, where we're free of our need to work things out and understand everything. And when we do that, well, we enter into a new territory of consciousness, of mindfulness, where what occurs to us is not just our past conditioning, our past programming, but new information that's relevant to whatever, we're faced with in life in that moment. So we're in this highly relevant state of mind that, in with this clarity, makes connections that are there to be made that we don't normally make, and sees possibilities that are there that we don't normally see. So, we become super creative, and it's this super creative state, our inherent sense of our inherent genius that really I believe we're looking for and that we're capable of, and it all stems through this ability to not know, to be an innocence. It's not about not knowing, it's about not needing to know. It's not needing to understand. It's not having that drive, because when that is engaged, it engages our egoic belief system. When it's not engaged, we engage reality and very objectively for what it is. Now, I mean, that's the essence, that's the basis of how we do it, of what it's about. It's an orientational shift. It's a paradigm shift, one from needing to know, needing to understand, and one not needing to know, not needing to understand. As Einstein said himself, one of the people we think of as one of the brainiest people of all time, I mean, he said that knowledge is far less important than imagination. And so our rational function isn't as useful as we think it is. There's a much more useful function, and that function is engaged by not needing to know. So that's the basis of it. But I mean, there's a whole skill around that. Least of which is this: is that when you go into a new territory and receive and gain new information, it's not going to make sense to you because you've been dismissing it all your life because it doesn't fit in with your preconceived sense of yourself and the world. And so it's going to be confronting, and you're going to tend to want to dismiss it. And so there's all kinds of disciplines and skills that you have to develop in developing a super conscious, intuitive way of seeing the world. And, that's why I chose to write a book about it and write about it in an interesting as way as I could, is, to convey these skills that are involved in shifting to this orientation, to this, higher mode of awareness, basically, I would call it.
Well, William, in one part of your book, you mentioned that there is no time and space and everything is one. So are you really saying in a few words that we should live in the now?
Thank you for cutting to the chase, Mike. That's what I'm saying. We should live in the now. But you see, the thing is, it's all very well to say live in the now, and Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now. That brilliant concepts. I mean, that is what we aspire to. But the thing is that you know, people struggle with and don't appreciate is that why we don't live in the now is because we're trying to resolve our identity. And we have identities because they are what gives us our sense of self. But the thing is what you're saying there's no time and space where everything's connected. That is the truth. And our true nature is a very connected nature. We're one with everything. But we don't want that oneness with everything in a sense because we're here for an individual experience of existence. And to have that, we've got to separate ourselves from everything else. And to do that, we've got to create an illusion. And that illusion is based on our identity, which is an idea of how separate we are and the ways in which we're separate. And you see, the side effect of that, though, is that then we have ideas about ourselves as being incomplete, as being unviable, that in some way or other, each of us has our own belief that we're not viable, that we're incomplete in some way. And so, you know, we have these urges to complete ourselves, to fix ourselves. And that's a preoccupation that takes us out of the moment, that takes us away from where we are and what we're doing. Because, you know, in our belief system, we don't believe we're ready for the moment. We don't believe we're viable just sitting here. We believe we've got to get some, you know, that there's something yet to be completed about ourselves. And so in our minds, although we're not aware of it, it's an unconscious process, we're off. We're, you know, like you could say, we're off there with the fairies working on ourselves, and that takes us away from here. So, you know, the deepest skill of all of this is to recognize, is having the self-awareness of what of your identity is impressing on you and calling on you to react to it. And being aware of that and then not being in reaction to it, rather than just going, well, I must be in the moment, I must be in the moment, I must be in the moment. When you stop reacting to your identity and stop, you know, acting in favor of your identity and stop, when you can hang out with the tension of your identity, and, you know, a big part of our identity is about needing to know how it is and resolve. You know, that tension of how is it, work it all out. When we can suspend that, well, then we are here in the now. We are present. And you're right, Mike. It is about being present. It is about being in the now. And, you know, there's more to it than people realize.
Yes, indeed. I would definitely go along with what you're saying. But just getting back to something we spoke about just a little earlier about the higher force or power that we're guided by, I guess it could be by any other name, our higher self or even God, but does it relate in any way to what you refer to as the inner child?
No. There's a real distinction in my language. I mean, In different people's modalities, you know, there's all different languaging for this. But I mean, in my sense of the word not. I mean, you know, to me, the inner child is just the. Well, there's two aspects to the inner child. I mean, when you raise it now, what occurs to me is my sense of more like the wounded child, the woundings that we have, that we, you know, when we're born and in our earliest years, we are trying to work, you know, we're creating our identity and establishing an identity, and you know, we're looking to understand how the world is, you know, what others are about, what we ourselves are about, and you know, we take on that identity through wounding, through a sense of being separate in some way, separate from our validity and our viability, and you know, it's that childhood phase where that wounding takes place. And so those, as a premise, those woundings and that phase and that side of ourselves that is carried energetically within us is, you know, is we personify it basically as the wounded child. But I mean, you could, you know, just characterize it as our identity, as our ego, as our wounded self, whatever. But, you know, the inner child actually gives it some kind of, you know, empathy and life, really, I guess.
So would you say that the inner child is more ourself rather than the ego, which I guess you would say is our 3D mind or something like that?
Well, it, as I said, you know, Mike, it just depends on your languaging because, you know, I've heard a lot about the inner child and from different people and different books, and everybody has a different model for it. I mean, you know, there's the creative child, and the creative child, you could say, is the inner child and as well, and that's that. But it's the creative child. It's the side of ourself that's more. You know, our authentic self, really, I guess, when people talk about the creative child, the part of ourselves that's connected to everything through all time and space. So there's something, they're using that term to convey something pristine. On the other hand, they can talk about the wounded child, which is being used to term something egoic, really, you know. So, as I say, it depends on your... you know, languaging, I guess, and it's not a big phraseology in my model, really, to be honest.
Okay, so what then is the complete self or the incomplete self?
Well, it's what I was talking about earlier is that look, in my understanding and experience is that we are. Our actual true nature, our true essence anyway, is pure creative spirit. We're connected to everything through all time and space. And as such, we're here for an individual experience of existence. So we've come here to create an individual experience of existence and an individual sense of existence. And I think we do it very successfully. I mean, there you are in England and here I am in Santa Monica in California. And I really think I am me, and I've got a really strong sense of being me, and you've got a very strong sense of being you over there, and you've got no sense of being me, and I've got no sense of being you. And so we've done that very successfully. But you know, how we did that, the thing is we have to fabricate that sense of individuality because we're not actually as individual as we feel and perceive that we are. So we've had to create that, and how we do that is we create an identity. We create a vehicle and an identity, and that identity is built on ideas of separation, built, you know, that we're separate from our safety, that we're separate from our worth, that we're separate from our belonging, that we're separate from our trust, from our perfection, you know, just from our capability, capacity, whatever it is. And so it's the sense of separation that we have formed that we then feel like we're incomplete and that the objective of our life then is to complete ourselves. We develop a compensating tendency which is about completing the sense of incompleteness that we have, which is actually an illusion. It causes us to just waste a whole lot of time. I mean, Neil Donald Walsh very bravely said, I would never have said this until he said it, but you know, he very bravely said that 98% of what people are involved in is a waste of time and energy, you know. And I agree with him. It's like so much of what people are involved in and are preoccupied with and whatever is not about really who they are and what really matters to them and what they'd really get on with. It's about resolving themselves and you know, preparing themselves to be here, you see. And so the incomplete self is, you know, just just another way of looking at our egoic nature. It's the side of ourselves that has an illusion of not being complete, not being ready for life, and is preoccupied with shoring that up. I mean, people with lack of worth are constantly looking for approval. It's a waste of energy. I do it because it's one of my things, you know. I do it much less now because of what I know about myself and life, but, you know, it still is a bit of a tendency. But, you know, people that believe they're not viable, that they're not safe, that have trust issues, spend a lot of energy hiding, not doing what they would normally do, or they spend a lot of energy actually testing safety and antagonizing people to see whether they're safe to be with or not. You know, just so all the personality types are different and are wasting a lot of energy involved in trying to, you know, complete themselves, resolve their identity. Whereas, you know, there is that side of ourselves that we can always connect with, that is there, whole, complete, connected to everything through time and space, ready to go, ready to create. And, in the Bible it says man has choice. And I really believe that that's our bottom line choice, is to be identified with our separate self, to be identified with our incomplete self, and trying to be resolving that, and prepare to live, or being identified with the side of ourselves that's actually whole, complete, viable now, ready to go, and be in that and just live.
Yes, indeed. Yes, very good explanation again. Now, in your book, and you make a statement which I'm sure is something that you obviously believe in. Indeed, you've been talking about creation. You said we have a natural ability that can create whatever we want with absolute ease. Now, some people might find that difficult to accept. What would you say to that one?
To people that would find it difficult to accept that we can create what we want with absolute ease?
Yes.
Well, I don't know what I'd say to them. I don't know that it really is important to convince them, as long as I can create with absolute ease. But you see, the thing is, Mike, to be serious, is that, you know, all our difficulties and our struggles in life are just a function of perception. We have a whole bunch of beliefs, as I said before, about ourselves, other than the others and the world, and how it is. And so we, you know, I do this all the time in seminars and what. I can actually very quickly show people how what they're struggling with is just a function of what they're paying attention to. See, so if anyone has a problem, what you'll find is that the problem has been created by their belief in the first instance, by how they pay attention. Like, I'll give you an example now, which I've already alluded to. If you, and I'm just thinking now of someone in particular that I worked with recently, where what they had was an experience of violation, where they get violated a lot in their lives. And so we looked at it and we deconstructed it. And so the first thing is that was revealed was how untrustworthy they were of the world and of others. And so there you could see, there's the belief. They're having an experience of being violated, and you could go, well, quite rightly, they shouldn't trust the world. But then underneath the surface, what you see is, yeah, but this person also doesn't trust the world and looks at the world in a very mistrustful way. And then furthermore, that perception creates a kind of a behavior where they test their safety a lot. and they, you know, in different ways, provoke other people. And so that provocation leads to actions and results. And, you know, I mean, I'm not just saying it in a hard, disheartened, you know, heartless way. I mean, the person that I was working with could see for themselves how they actually created their violations by virtue of what it is, the way they focused, and then what they make important, and then the behaviors and the actions that result in themselves and the people around them as a result of that, you know, preoccupation. And so you see that in the end, that it's the belief that's creating reality. So imagine now using the same person as example who has an experience of life being tough because of the violation that they experience wherever they go. So that's their struggle. But now imagine if they stop provoking people, then the violation is going to cease to a large degree, or actually entirely, really, I would say mostly in their case. And so then you can see, well, their suffering and their struggling would stop. And the thing is, you can then go to anybody. Anybody can put up their hand and go, yeah, but mine's financial difficulty. you know, mine's emotional difficulty. Mine's psychological difficulty. But if you deconstruct whatever's happening for anybody, and I've done this till the cows come home, you can see that they have a belief, and then that belief creates that reality. And if they see through that belief, if they see through their behaviors, and they actually stop behaving in that way and stop lending that belief power, then, you know, whatever it is that they're struggling with, the struggle ceases or diminishes hugely anyway. And so it's a function of self-awareness. And which has a lot to do with what we're talking about today, which has a lot to do with the shaman, the last shaman, because as I was saying earlier, right at the beginning, the last shaman is a metaphor for the gaining of wisdom, of self-awareness. And when one has this kind of self-awareness, one can see what one is creating, and then, you know, take the power out of that and lend it to something that's going to lead to a different result. And, you know, it might, from the outside, it looks like magic, as though something's happened by magic, but actually, it's actually quite almost, in a sense, logical and mechanical how you can change your experience of life and your reality, basically.
Yes, well, that ties in again with what you've said in your book, that focus creates reality.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's very good. William, I think we've possibly come to the end of my main questions. I could go on a bit, but I feel for one I ought to ask you, do you actually have a website that people can read more about you?
Absolutely, williamwhitecloud.com. And, you know, there's a lot of information on the subject we've been talking about, a lot of resources that can help people live with the wisdom and clarity that we've been talking about here. And also, I've got some events coming up in London and Los Angeles at the end of this month and into next month. And if you're in those necks of the woods, please look up those dates and come along. I've got some, short evening trainings on the very subject we're talking about here, about how to, you know, create success as a natural part of your life. And right. Love everyone to come along. Everybody's welcome. Certainly those that can make it in this instance.
Fine. Now, where can people get your book, or is there information on your website?
Well, yeah, that's right. On the website, You know, I mean, the book's available on every digital platform like Amazon, iTunes, Barnes & Noble, you know, Sony, you name it. And also, actually, you can walk into any bookstore and order it, The Last Shaman or The Magician's Way by William Whitecloud. If they don't have it, they can order it. But, you know, it's also available on the website. And as I say, there's a lot of information on the website, even free chapters that you can read on the books.
Hmm. Well, I mean, having fully read your book, I must say it's a very almost clever way with which to put your message over. And at the same time, it's a very interesting story that builds up as the book goes along. And I would say, personally, it's one of those which you have to know what happened in the end.
You do, Mike. But it's been great talking to you. You know, it's, I hope that the technical difficulties we had won't matter in the end, because the end result that counts. And it's been a thoroughly enjoyable chat. And sadly, I'm coming to the end of this little. Well, it's been a massive radio campaign that I've had, and I'm nearly in tears now to think I've only got two or three more interviews left in the campaign. So thanks for your interest and support, Mike. Much appreciated.
Well, you're very welcome, and you're a very good speaker, I must say, and you certainly know your own subject very well, which helps a lot. No, I wish you every success with the book. It's a very good story. I don't read novels very often, but I was quite intrigued by your story. It's very good.
I know.
Very well put over.
Thanks. Right. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. So sorry about the little hitches, but they won't show when we get the recording put into the archive.
Well, that's great. And, God bless you and everyone listening. And you know the thought that I'm always left with, Mike, is
yes.
Joseph Campbell. You know Joseph Campbell, don't you? The mythology guru. Hey, he always used to say that the psychotic is drowning in the same water that the mystic is swimming in. You know,
yes.
You know. I mean, it's really our choice. What we're going to be? Are we going to be a psychotic thrashing around in life, or are we going to be cruising through life? And I hope that's something that my books can help people with when they have a read of them.
Yes, I think something always rubs off, even if we haven't really made a specific note. I mean, everything you've said sort of gone inside the mind, hasn't it, somewhere?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, thank you very much, William. It's been enjoyable having you on the program.
Thanks, Mike. Talk to you later, hey?
Indeed, yes. Thank you.
Bye.
Well, folks, as I inevitably say, that was a very good interview. Sorry about the technical hitches. Hope you lasted out through that rather long break in the middle somewhere or at the beginning. I haven't got a definite guest for next week, but I am in touch with Caroline Corey, and I'm waiting her reply and hoping she can come on, because I want to talk to her about her new movie. So thank you for being with me, and hope you can make it next week. God bless you all. Thank you.